On 88.1 WIPR, I'm Tom Hall. This is Maryland Morning. Continuing our series of conversations as we approach the one-year anniversary of the funeral of Freddie Gray and the violence that followed, Dr. Cheryl Grills and Enola Aird on new strategies for mental health in communities of color. Black Minds Matter, a call for liberation from mental slavery through emotional emancipation. Then our sports guru, Mark Hyman, divines the ingredients that have led to the Orioles' best start ever. Plus, this is the time of year we think about the inevitability of death and taxes. Tomorrow is National Healthcare Decision Day. Dr. Marion Grant on why it always seems too early until it's too late to make decisions about advanced care planning. Gil Sandler has a Baltimore story. Nathan's got the local news. Maryland Morning kicks off right after these headlines.
I'm producer Rob Sivak. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our minds. Have no fear for atomic energy, 'cause none of them can stop the time.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Today is Emancipation Day, a holiday in Washington, D.C. that marks the anniversary of the signing of the Compensated Emancipation Act by Abraham Lincoln in 1862. That's the piece of legislation that freed the slaves in Washington by essentially buying them from their owners. That law preceded by about 9 months President Lincoln's signing of the Emancipation Proclamation in January of 1863. Emancipation Day is celebrated on April 16th, except when April 16th is on a Saturday, when it moves to April 15th. And by the way, because that has happened this year, our tax returns aren't due until Monday. So this morning, we'll begin with a conversation about a different kind of emancipation, the emotional emancipation from the mental slavery that often affects communities of color. Tonight, the Black Mental Health Alliance will present a panel discussion at Coppin State University about how perceptions of Africans and African Americans can have a crippling effect on communities of color and why African-centered approaches to mental health treatment are crucial to addressing the psychological health of minorities in Baltimore and beyond. Two of the panelists at tonight's event join me here in Studio A this morning. Dr. Cheryl Grills is professor of psychology at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles and the immediate past president of the Association of Black Psychologists. Enola Aird is a lawyer and a founder of and president of Community Healing Network. Good morning and welcome to you both. It's great to meet you.
Good morning.
Thank you for having us here.
So Dr. Grills, community psychology. Tell us what that field entails. When we think about psychology, it's usually, you know, one-on-one counseling. What do you mean by community psychology?
Well, I'm actually a trained clinical psychologist who's defected to community psychology because we understand in community psychology that it is important to look at the root causes of some of the mental health problems that people experience in the world. So if we're looking at large numbers of people experiencing depression or increased rates of suicide, we need to ask the question, why is this happening? And is it something beyond the individuals? Is there something stressful in their life? Is there something about our public policies that's contributing to that? And then let's address that, and we can help a larger number of people than we can have help in one-on-one psychotherapy.
So you're really very much involved in public policy and analysis and data about what's going on socially, culturally, politically.
Exactly, and historically.
Uh-huh. Interesting. And Ms. Aird, you're an attorney in Connecticut, and you founded the Community Healing Network. What kind of work do you do?
We're focused on basically building a global movement, grassroots movement, for the emotional emancipation of Black people to help Black people overcome, heal from, and overturn what we see as the root causes of the devaluing of Black lives, the lies of white superiority and Black inferiority. We think we've got to get at that in order to get at racism. It's under the hood of racism, these lies, and it's what props up racism. And we think that Black lives will continue not to matter as much as white lives do, as long as these lies control our social environment.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Grills, is it a danger, or is it a concern that these lies about the lack of value of Black lives are being internalized by African Americans? I mean, are they almost, you know, sort of forced to believe the fiction?
Yes. So if you tell someone day in and day out, over the course of their lives, and you tell their parents and their parents' parents and their parents' parents the same thing about who you are, at some point it becomes difficult to deny the potential reality of that. And so not only is there a danger that one begins to internalize that, there's an ongoing struggle to try to ward against it. There's a constant pressure to try to discern, is this real, is this not real? And that pressure, that stress, begins to impact physical health as well as mental health.
And Enola Aird, is there a particular capacity for community healing, community addressing these issues in community that you know, is better than, in other words, these therapeutic approaches better than individual?
Well, it's certainly complementary. We believe that the community is experiencing these assaults communally, and we think it's very, very important that we come together and recognize that wherever we are in the world as Black people, we are confronted with these lies. We are confronted with them in ways that are not only internalized and are harmful, as Dr. Grills has said, but they also inform implicit biases. So when the policeman looks at a Black person, he doesn't see always a human being. He sees someone who's been defined over the course of four centuries as less than, in some cases in the animal kingdom, unfortunately, because of this hierarchy that's been created. So it's all of us. It doesn't matter if we're the President of the United States, a member of Congress, or a young man or woman walking along the street.
And as you say, it's four centuries worth.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I mean, this has been going on for
a long time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Grills, how much of this, or is there a generational dimension of this? When I think, for example, of the Black Lives Matter movement, when I talk to the leaders and the people who are involved here in Baltimore in the Black Lives movement, mm-hmm. locally, these are young people, and they don't appear to me to have any problems understanding their worth and the value that they contribute to our community. I just wonder if generationally it's more difficult for their parents and their grandparents than it is for the, you know, the kids who are in their teens and 20s now.
Well, in our emotional emancipation circles, we have found children in middle school who are struggling with the effects of racism on them. The issue is that they don't necessarily have a safe space where they can talk about these things, unpack them, and realize that they're not the only ones going through it. Understand that they have feelings that are real and that are warranted and that are connected to some things having to do with the fact that we live in a racialized world and having nothing to do with the value and capacity of them as human beings.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. I'm joined in the studio this morning by Dr. Cheryl Grills. She's a professor of psychology at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles. And Enola Aird is here as well. She's the founder and president of Community Healing Network. So, Ms. Aird, I understand that after the uprising here in Baltimore about a year ago, you put together several of these community healing emotional emancipation circles. Tell us how that grew out of the uprising and what
work
you've done.
We actually have been doing work here in Maryland through a young woman named Charlene Phipps for I think maybe two or three years before that. But when the uprising occurred, we felt it was very necessary for us to be here to offer in a more intense way this emotional emancipation circle. So we gathered about 100 people over at the Urban Business Center one night, and that was kind of the beginning of the intensified movement here in Baltimore. And there has been a emotional emancipation circle meeting at the Urban Business Center since then. There are apparently now two emotional emancipation circles in zip codes 17 and 23. Mm-hmm. And the
Which
hope
is where the nexus of the uprising was.
And mm-hmm. the the hope is to really expand and have emotional emancipation circles throughout the city. I should note that this is, as I said earlier, a global movement. We've got emotional emancipation circles in more than 20 cities across the country and in the United Kingdom, Cuba, thanks to Dr. Grills, who's been doing yeoman work in spreading this message across the African diaspora.
Dr. Grills, I think I'm correct in recalling that I had Ms. Phipps on the show a few years ago, and we discussed this, and I didn't look it up officially, but I certainly recall that happened. Tell us how an emancipation circle works. What is the work that gets done, and how is it approached?
Well, when people come together in community, we actually invite an opportunity to actually stop and take a moment to breathe. Because as Black folk, under the pressure of racism, we don't even realize that we're not breathing normally. And we take stock of how is racism affecting me in my life, at home, at school, at the workplace, on the streets. And then how do I begin to relieve myself, to free myself from the oppressive effects of what are, in some instances, like racial paper cuts that happen throughout the day, week after week? And then how do I begin to connect with other folks who are going through the same thing? For white people, survival is a daily experience that they take for granted. But for Black folk, it's a daily act of intentionality and purpose. In fact, I say it's a revolutionary act. And we need to appreciate that and the effects that it takes on us. And agencies and organizations, rather, like Black Mental Health Alliance, have really been at the forefront in Baltimore of trying to make sure that we have these circles and that they grow and that people have the opportunity to train and experience and participate in them.
And Ms. Harry, we just have a few seconds left, but the counter, the antidote to racism then is self-confidence, self-value, self-worth.
I mean, it's not just about self. It's about the fact that there's been, for, as we said, 400 years, this notion that white people are superior and Black people are inferior. What we need to do is to challenge and dismantle that system. So it's internal work, yes, but Community Healing Network is not just about internal work. It's also about external work.
External as well. Okay, well, I appreciate you both being here, and I hope it goes well this evening at Coppin. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Dr. Cheryl Grills is a professor of psychology at Loyola Marymount University in L.A. Enola Aird is the founder and president of Community Healing Network. They'll be part of a panel sponsored by the Black Mental Health Alliance tonight at Coppin State at 6 o'clock. Topic is liberation from mental slavery through emotional emancipation. We've got a link to details on our website, wypr.org/Marilyn Morning. We're going to talk sports with Mark Hyman after a break for news. First, here's Mr. Sterner.
Thanks, Tom. You're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast, a service of your public radio, WYPR, in Baltimore. Find more podcasts at WYPR.org and tell us what you think by email, mdmorning@WYPR.org. Now, back to the podcast.
Something magic happens every time you go. You make the magic happen. The magic of Orioles baseball. When the game is close and the O's are hot, there's a thundering roar from 34 to give it all they've got.
Oh, how about them O's, hon? Let's talk sports here on Maryland Morning, or more specifically, let's wallow in the glory that is the best start to an Orioles season in the history of Orioles season starts. They won the first 7 games. They have lost the last 2, but they are off to a phenomenal beginning. We can also talk about what may be one of the most ignominious endings to a Masters golf tournament, which we'll do with the gentleness and lack of vitriol we're known for, because let's face it, whether it's golf or tennis or bowling or any other similar pursuit, when we witnessed Jordan Spieth melting down at the Masters, we've been there, done that. Not at the Masters necessarily, but we've been there, done that in other places. Our resident sports guy, Mark Hyman, joins me today in Studio A. He's on the faculty of George Washington University, the author of 2,694 books, the latest of which is called Concussions and Our Kids. Hey, Mark, how you doing?
Delighted to be here, Tom.
I'm glad to see you. So, what do we make of this incredible start? Best start in the majors. They were the only undefeated team up to a couple of nights ago in the major leagues. You know, as of last, you know, early last week, they were on track to finish 162-0, as Justin Fenton noted in a tweet from the Sun. What should we think about this?
Well, the cynic in me, and that's one of my more appealing qualities, wants to caution the audience that it is very early in the season and not to make too much of this. But as it turns out, there are 26 teams in Major League history that have begun the season 7-0, and every one of them has finished 500 or better. So I think that's pretty encouraging. The average final record for those 26 teams was 93-69, which I think we would take. Wouldn't you take that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay,
and so we would certainly win the division with that kind of. Win the division by
that would be very competitive. I think you would either win the division or be the wild card and advance to the postseason. Mm-hmm. So things are looking good.
And a bunch of individuals having really blazing starts. I switched back and forth between the game and Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton last night. But I did switch into the game when Mark Trumbo hit his 400th homer this season. He just seems that he gets one every other time at bat. He's terrific.
Well, as usual, you're overstating things slightly. Mark Trumbo.
I am known to hyperbole. That's right.
Mark Trumbo, one of the newer Orioles, has 3 home runs. Encouraging. Chris Davis has hit 4, which we're pleased about since he's making $20 million a year now. Manny Machado.
Don't do the math, Mark. We don't want to know how many millions each home run costs.
No.
We just don't want to know that.
But that's an encouraging start, and he seems
and
very
Machado,
comfortable.
Machado
to
is doing great. Yeah. There's a piece in the Sun this morning about...
You're reading my mind. He's hitting .421. You know, terrific start, obviously. Some other encouraging signs. The rotation, the starting pitching is going to be a question all year long. And I don't think we have very many answers about that yet. But the middle relief has been pretty amazing. Tyler Wilson, Brad Brock, and Darren O'Day have pitched 17 scoreless innings this season. That's pretty good.
Yeah, that's great.
So the Oriole bullpen, I think, is going to be a strength of the pitching staff, and we'll just have to see about the starting pitching.
And guys like Chris Tillman, I mean, he looked pretty good for about 5 innings last night.
Well,
then,
right.
Then stuff happened, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit about Joey Rickard, the young outfielder.
What a great
outfielder.
Story this is. Yeah.
Amazing story. He's hitting over 300, and he's played all 3 outfield positions. In 9 games, he's played all 3 outfield positions. And I think there's a desire, a temptation to think that this guy is really going to be the answer. And in this case, I think caution is indicated. Because remember that Joey Rickard is 25. Before this season, he'd played 29 games in AAA. AAA.
Right.
So
And that's not the next step up to... The next step up from AAA is not the major leagues.
Is the major leagues, yeah. Uh-huh. So 29 games in the minor leagues, at the highest level of the minor leagues. Everything before that was below AAA. So, I think there's a lot to learn yet about Joey Rickard. He's an exciting player, but let's not put too much on his shoulders.
Yes, but it's just such a great story. There he is at opening day at Camden Yards, his first at-bat. He gets a single, then he gets, then he hits a home run. And, Joey, already starting, within the second game of the season.
Yeah, and he's Buck Showalter's kind of player. You know, you get the feeling that he would run through a brick wall, several times if Buck Showalter asked him to do that. So he's a player who's easy to root for.
And, of course, we've won 7 games, and Adam Jones has not been 100% physically.
Yeah. So in that sense, we haven't seen the Orioles really at full strength yet. I think it's a great, starting lineup, 1-9. And the starting pitching is going to be the question.
Yeah, well, it's fun to watch so far. We're having a good time, that's for sure. Let's talk a little bit about Terps Hoops. Men's Terps Hoops in particular, University of Maryland apparently losing freshman Diamond Stone and sophomore Mello Trimble. They're going to enter the NBA draft. It's interesting. Trimble's case, he had a great freshman year and a not-so-great sophomore year. What kind of position does he go into the draft with? I mean, he had a good year. He had a solid year as a sophomore, but he was not the standout superstar.
Yeah, Stone and Trimble are slightly different cases in terms of their status for the NBA draft. Stone hired an agent. For that reason, he is now considered a professional. He can't go back to Maryland. Trimble has not hired an agent. He's declared his interest in exploring the possibility of turning pro. So he has until May 25th to declare his intentions, and the draft is in June. So we don't know. It's possible that Trimble could be back, although I would say the odds are against it. You know, it's interesting. Since 2006, the NBA has had a rule that requires players who enter the draft to be 19 years old and to be 1 year removed from high school. 1 year removed. So they don't have to go to college for 1 year, but that's the typical path, because if you want to play in the NBA, you want that year of experience at the highest level. And, you know, players like Diamond Stone, you wonder whether that really serves their interest. Would Diamond Stone have been better playing in the NBA if he could have gone directly from high school into the NBA? Wouldn't that have been in his interest? Now the NBA...
Because he would have gotten paid some money.
Exactly. Exactly. The NBA is, you know, perpetuates this system because they view the college game as, you know, a free minor league for them. And they want to delay the time in which these kids can declare and come into the NBA as long as they can, because they want them to develop at the college level. And in fact, Adam Silver, the commissioner of the NBA, is on record as favoring increasing the minimum age for being eligible for the draft from 19 to 20. So that's the NBA's perspective. But, you know, if you look at the kids, I wonder whether this is a fair system. In fact, I more than wonder. You know, a kid who needs, you know, is an economic need and has the ability, or, you know, certainly their NBA is willing to draft these kids, why should they have to go to college for a year or two when that's really not part of their plan?
Yeah, but the NBA gets virtually a free minor league system. I mean, the Major League Baseball pays for its minor league system, right?
Exactly. So, you know, it really serves the interest of the NBA.
Doesn't football kind of do the same thing? I mean, college football becomes the farm system for the NFL, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a good question. Players, you know, in the sport of football, high school players are not ready physically to play in the NFL. They would be destroyed in the NFL. I mean, we know how difficult football is on the body of 22 and 3-year-olds, much less 17 and 18-year-olds. So there'd be no way that a high school player would be desirable to an NFL team in a draft, but not so in basketball.
Speaking of the NBA, it's been quite an exciting week in the NBA. Let's talk about Stephen Curry and the fact that Golden State Warriors have now set a record for number of wins in a season, 73 wins, led by Mr. Curry, who the other night in the final game of the season had 10 3-point baskets, and just it was and I don't know, 40 or 50 points total or something like that. He's a phenomenon. And speaking about, you know, the NBA farm system, he went to Davidson College. I mean, nobody, which is not a big, you know, powerhouse basketball team. He was so much under the radar when he was in college. And now he's, you know, the dominant player in the league. That's a great story that they won as many games as they did, isn't it?
Yeah. Steph Curry is the ultimate late bloomer. You know, gives me hope that maybe I should still be working on my, you know, jump shot. He, you know, coming out of high school, he was not, as you point out, he was not heavily recruited. His dad, Del Curry, was an NBA player, played college basketball at Virginia Tech, and Virginia Tech barely recruited Steph Curry. If, you know, finally got an opportunity to play at Davidson, and now I think you could say it is the greatest perimeter shooter in the history of the NBA,
yeah.
6 years later. You know, this year
he broke his record for 3-pointers this year that he set last year.
Well, not only broke it, but destroyed it.
Shattered it.
He made more than 400 3-point shots this year, breaking his own record of like 286. Last year he broke it by 40%. So Steph Curry is arguably the greatest shooter in the history of the NBA, with apologies to Jerry West.
Yeah.
So, just an amazing story.
And perhaps is he the successor to Kobe Bryant in terms of generation? And Kobe Bryant played his last game after a 20-year career. That is interesting. And it's a different kind of highlight reel, Kobe Bryant's highlight reel, than, say, Michael Jordan or somebody like that. But how do you assess the importance of Kobe Bryant to the game?
Well, definitely a passing of the torch. You know, Kobe playing his last game this week, scoring 60 points in his last game. But having said that, what a disappointing, kind of sour way to go out. Kobe Bryant's last season, he was last in the league in 3-point shootings, 28% compared to Curry's 45%. And the Lakers were terrible, terrible. They won, what, 19 games?
Yeah, they're not in the playoffs by a long shot.
Just awful. So, you know, people sometimes say, you know, should athletes play, you know, beyond did Kobe play too long? He made $25 million this year, so maybe he didn't play too long, but the performance was pretty pathetic.
Speaking of pathetic performance, he said with a cruel segue, let's talk about Jordan Spieth and the back nine of the Masters. I happen to see this as well. There was a par three hole that he put two balls, not one, but two, into the water. He was leading the Masters at that time. He had four or five holes to go. It was a meltdown unlike, you know, we're used to seeing.
Well, not a historic meltdown. I remember I was covering the Masters in 1980 for The Sun and just happened to be at the 12th hole when a golfer named Tom Weisskopf, very prominent golfer at the time, was playing the 12th. Tom Weisskopf put five balls in the water, made a 13 on that hole. And I had the exciting task of following him back to the clubhouse to interview him about that.
Oh, bet he was in a good mood.
Well, I don't remember exactly. It was something like, get out of my face, shorty. I think he was looking into the sun. He couldn't really tell how tall I was. But it was a pretty big meltdown and a pretty inopportune time to have it.
But in Mr. Spieth's and Mr. Weisskopf's defense, we should say that it's 160-yard par 3, and it's considered one of the hardest holes in all of golf.
Yeah, I mean, it's an iconic hole. Anybody, whether you play golf or not, you're probably familiar with the 12th hole at Augusta.
But Jordan Spieth really handled it quite elegantly and quite graciously. He's the defending champion, so he's the one who had to stand there and pass the jacket to the new champion. He's a pretty class act, and he's a very young gentleman, isn't he?
Yeah, and in some ways, I think what it did was affirm Under Armour's investment in Jordan Spieth. Remember, Under Armour signed a 10-year sponsorship agreement with Spieth last year after he won the U.S. Open. And even though he didn't win the tournament, so much good feeling and good publicity and, you know, reflecting well on Under Armour as a brand.
I was interested because there were a couple of stories saying, is this going to hurt Under Armour that he had the meltdown? But, you know, certainly that Under Armour logo was on international television for hours and hours and hours. It can't hurt the marketing part of it. Right?
And that's what these brands are paying for, the television exposure. And Jordan Spieth led the tournament all 4 days going into, you know, he led the tournament after round one and led the tournament going into rounds two, three, and four. So great week for Under Armour.
Yeah, talk about getting your money's worth. Folks who play women's soccer have made the case that they are giving the Women's Soccer League more than their money's worth. They are paid considerably less than the men, but their crowds and their popularity is considerably greater than the men. This is I count this among a big step forward. What are their chances of getting pay parity?
Well, it's time for soccer to get with it. I mean, many other sports have recognized that women deserve parity in compensation years ago. In women's tennis, all four majors, the women make equal money, and it's time for women's soccer to do that. Look, the women who make the World Cup team make $15,000 for that privilege. The men make $69,000. There's no justification for that. The women have won 3 World Cups and I think 5 Olympic gold medals. How can you possibly make the argument?
And their crowds are bigger.
Exactly. I mean, the largest crowd in the history of soccer in the U.S. was the 1999 World Cup, you know, the famous Brandi Chastain game where she ripped off her jersey. I think it's a very empty argument. I'd be curious to see what the defense of that position is.
A parallel to women's tennis. For a while, women's tennis, the prize money was, you know, half of what the men's were. The argument at one point was that the men play 5 sets to win. The women play at, a maximum of 3. But eventually, there's parity, I think, in pretty much all the majors. Maybe not Wimbledon. I can't remember.
No, Wimbledon in 2007 equalized the pay. The U.S. Open since 1973. Has paid women what it pays men.
Yeah, so, I mean, there are some parallels here. Yeah. Speaking of women, before we go, I want to mention University of Connecticut women's basketball team. They won their 4th straight national championships. There were kids on that team, freshman through senior, who never had a year in which they didn't win the national championship. That's an amazing, amazing accomplishment.
Yeah, 4 in a row. And there's been some talk that, is this good for women's basketball to have one dominant team? Of course it's good. Is Steph Curry good for the NBA?
Yeah.
No argument.
All right. Thanks, Mark. Good to see you. And we'll see you next time. Appreciate it. Mark Hyman is on the faculty of George Washington University and the author of several books, the latest of which is called Concussions and Our Kids. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up, some advice about some important decisions you can make if you've not already made them on Healthcare Decision Day, which is tomorrow.
Is there an issue that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org, or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
Welcome back. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Today is April 15th, which is normally the day our tax returns are due. This year, we get a few more days to complete that chore. We've got until Monday for that. But April 15th always brings to mind the old saying that the two things you can count on in life are death and taxes. Well, it's the death part that helps explain why tomorrow, April 16th, has been named National Healthcare Decisions Day. It's a day to raise awareness about end-of-life healthcare decisions, choices about how you want to be treated medically if you're unable to speak for yourself, and about who should speak for you if you're not able to speak. Marion Grant knows a lot about this. She holds a doctorate in nursing. She's the director of policy and professional engagement at the Coalition to Transform Advanced Care. She's also an associate professor at the University of Maryland School of Nursing and a certified nurse practitioner who practices on the University of Maryland Medical Center's Palliative Care Service. Last year, Dr. Grant was a Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Health Policy Fellow. She worked both in Nancy Pelosi's office and at the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation. Welcome. Good to see you.
Same here, Tom.
So, National Healthcare Decisions Day, what are the kinds of decisions folks need to be making?
So I think that the decisions we hope that people can think about is what would they want to do if they became really seriously ill but couldn't make decisions for themselves. So we're talking about things like life support. How long would you want to have life support if you couldn't get better? Would you want to be given artificial nutrition? Those kinds of things.
And of course, it's not only a good thing for us as individuals, it's a really good thing for our families and our friends and the people who love us and care for us. If we're not specific about what our requests are, they're going to have to guess.
I would say it's more important for them than it is for us, because they are going to be the ones holding the bag. I mean, they're the ones that we're turning to in the hospital to make these decisions. And this is what I do all the time. I meet families in the ICU, and you know, it's difficult if you have a loved one who's seriously sick anyway, but if you have no idea of what their wishes are, it's even worse. So it's quite a gift that you could give your loved ones. We talk about giving them the gift of certainty.
And of course, this isn't just for people who, you know, have a very serious illness or have been even diagnosed as terminally ill. This needs to happen for every person who's not a child under the care of a guardian, right?
Absolutely. I mean, my fantasy is that every American from, you know, the age of 16 on would have them. I think that's unrealistic. And there hasn't actually been talk about, should we have this as something that we encourage people when they get a driver's license? Because, I mean, think about it. You're driving. Your chances for being in an accident go up. And what are your loved ones supposed to do if you are in a horrible accident and they have to make difficult decisions? So, yeah. So really, anybody could benefit from having them.
Right. This is not just for people who happen to be very ill.
Now, no, although I would say that many people who are seriously ill don't have them either. So that is really very frustrating.
I notice that in hospitals, even when you check into the hospital these days, they ask you if you have an advance directive.
You know, as a policy person in Washington, I think that's a perfect example of something that was well-intentioned but isn't really making a difference. So, yes, we have to ask every patient on admission if they have these things. But think about when you get admitted to the hospital. It's usually not a great time for reflection. So most people say no, and we dutifully chart that no, they don't have them. And then there's no mechanism in the hospital typically to follow up unless things get really bad and then I come to see you.
Right. And you come to see them in your capacity as a palliative care
nurse
person
practitioner.
Who's
yeah.
going to help a person on their exit.
Yeah. Well, or at least I'm going to help somebody who's seriously ill, perhaps life-threateningly ill, and their family make difficult decisions about, you know, they're in the ICU. Are they going to get out of the ICU? Are they going to get out of the hospital? How should we spend this last, you know, whatever time we have left?
Is it just a matter, is it just as simple as people just don't want to think about dying? Is that it? I mean, you're dealing with these families and with these patients every day in your life. What are you finding the barriers to having advanced directives and to making these wishes clear are?
I think they fall into two categories. First of all, none of us wants to think about this, right? Tom Finucane, who's a geriatrician at Hopkins Bayview, is fond of saying that people have an abiding interest in not being dead. And that is absolutely true, but we complicate that by also having an abiding interest in not thinking about being dead. And then I think these conversations are difficult. I mean, when do you bring this up? You know, the Terry Schiavo case a few years ago was in a weird way helpful because even though that family was struggling with what was the right thing to do.
Yeah, you know, this is a family on life support.
She had had cardiac arrest and then was in a persistent vegetative state.
It became a hot potato political issue in the presidential campaign.
Exactly. Yeah. The husband said she wouldn't have wanted. The family said she would. She didn't have paperwork. But at least when that happened, a lot of Americans turned to one another and said, I either would want that or I wouldn't want that. And that was really, you could actually use that in the hospital to say, okay, well, now you know that case. It's like cleaning out the garage. You know, we all know we need to do it, but it's not high on anybody's list of fun things to do.
And as you say, I mean, the tagline about this is it's always too soon until it's too late for an advanced
directive.
Yeah. Absolutely. What's involved in an advanced directive? What are the components?
There are two components. One is just talking about what your wishes are for medical care, and that talks about life support and things like dialysis or artificial nutrition. The other thing is naming someone to make decisions for you when you can't. And that is really important because even though you can put things down on a piece of paper, none of us knows how it's going to end specifically or what's going to be the issue medically. So if at least loved ones have been, you know, designated to decide for you, and then you have to have conversations with them. Sometimes people fill out the forms, name somebody, and then we need to call that person. Then they're like, what do you say? I have no idea. He never talked about that with me. So those are the two components, your wishes and who should make those decisions.
So the forms are important. The hospital has to have the forms, and we'll have a link that you can get to those forms. But the conversations are even more important.
Right. And in the absence of forms, we will take anything in the hospital. So if you haven't gotten around to doing the paperwork, that's okay, at least if you've discussed things with somebody that they could answer our questions. I mean, we're going to ask two questions of a family of somebody who's critically ill. Are there forms? And if not, did they ever express their wishes? And if you at least know the answer to the latter, we'll go with it.
No, so it doesn't have to be an official sign, you know,
it doesn't.
Notarized
it doesn't.
Thing. I mean,
well, it can't be because we know from research consistently that less than 30% of Americans have these. So I meet patients all the time who have end-stage cancer who don't have these forms. So at least if they've talked with their loved ones, we'll go with that.
Interesting. All right. Well, thank you. It's a subject, as you say, that nobody wants to talk about, but it's important to talk about. And tomorrow is the day that we're encouraging everybody to step up and make sure this is taken care of. Appreciate it, Marion.
Thanks for giving me the chance, Tom. Bye.
Dr. Marion Grant is the Director of Policy and Professional Engagement at the Coalition to Transform Advanced Care. She's also an associate professor at the University of Maryland School of Nursing, and she practices on the University of Maryland Medical Center's Palliative Care Service. National Healthcare Decision Day is tomorrow. We've got a link to information about resources that can help with your advanced care planning on our website. Come on over to wipr.org/Maryland Morning. That's it for us today. Coming up Monday, as we approach the anniversary of the uprising last spring, a conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist E.R. Shipp in advance of a panel that she's appearing on to talk about the future of Baltimore a year after the uprising. Plus, center stage artistic director Kwame Kwe Arma on Detroit 67, a new play that very much resonates in Baltimore 2016. Theater critic J. Wynn Russick will also be here with her review of the new show at Rep Stage and a new book of short stories by a Palestinian author who teaches in Harford County. Hope you can join us Monday morning for Maryland Morning. Our director, engineer, and co-host is Nathan Sterner. The show is produced by Rob Sivak, Bridget Armstrong, and Kathleen Cahill. Lauren Ferguson is our intern. Austin Coughlin from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Maryland Morning theme music. Coffee for our guests provided by Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville. You can find them online at zekescoffee.com. I'm Tom Hall. Send me a tweet at Tom Hall, WIPR, or at Maryland Morning. check out our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. And one last thing, early voting is underway. It goes until next Thursday. Election day is April 26th. You gotta vote. You're gonna vote, right? Of course you are. Thanks for voting, and thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.